Welcome to SLP Nerdcast. I'm Kate.
And I'm Amy, and we appreciate you tuning in. In our podcast, we review and provide commentary on resources, literature, and we discuss issues related to the field of speech-language pathology.
You can use this podcast for ASHA professional development and CEUs. For more information about us and certification maintenance hours or CEUs, go to our website, www.slpnerdcast.com. SLP Nerdcast is brought to you by listeners like you. Even small contributions keep our CEU prices low and our program ad-free. You can contribute on our website by clicking Support Our Work. You can also find permanent product, notes, and other handouts. Some items are free, others are not, but everything is always affordable. You can go to our website to submit a call for papers to come on the show and present with us. Contact us anytime on Facebook, Instagram, or at info@slpnerdcast.com. We love hearing from our listeners, and we can't wait to learn what you have to teach us.
Just a quick disclaimer, the contents of this episode are not meant to replace clinical advice. SLP Nerdcasts, its hosts, and guests do not represent or endorse specific products or procedures mentioned during our episodes unless otherwise stated. We are not PhDs, but we do research our material. We do our best to provide a thorough review and fair representation of each topic that we tackle. That being said, it's always likely that there's an article that we've missed or another perspective that we haven't shared. If you have something that you'd like to add to the conversation, please email us. We love to hear from you.
Amy, I'm so excited for today.
I am too.
So we have the great pleasure of welcoming Dr. Trina Spencer and Dr. Doug Peterson. Welcome, Trina and Doug.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We should be thanking you. We're so glad that you're here.
Yes, Trina and Doug, you are here to discuss dynamic assessments and their importance in the field of speech-language pathology, which is super exciting. I'm really looking forward to learning from you guys. But before we get started, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourselves?
Sure. You want me to go first?
I think that would be perfect.
Go for it.
Okay, I'm Trina Spencer. I am Associate Professor at University of South Florida at the Right Path Research and Innovation Center. The bulk of my work is around clinical practice research in communication sciences. I do academic language, literacy. In particular, I'm interested in the prevention of reading comprehension problems. I work with kids with autism, with English language learners, the whole broad spectrum of all kids. Right. I also love to work with preschool teachers, gen ed teachers, special ed teachers, and my favorite, speech language pathologists, of course. And I also am a huge advocate for interprofessional collaboration. So if you find areas in which there might be little, you know, conflict brewing, I usually try to squirrel in there and see if I can participate in the calm, peaceful collaboration. I definitely believe in collaboration and working together.
Doug, how about you?
I think it'd be easier, Trina, for you to list the things you don't do. Is there anything you're not interested in? Don't answer that. So I'm Douglas Peterson. I'm a professor at Brigham Young University in the Department of Communication Disorders. And I research dynamic assessment, among other things, but this is a passion of mine, so I'm excited to talk about it. So I research dynamic assessment and something very related, which is multi-tiered systems of support, focusing on both comprehension and decoding for reading and language disorders and literacy for children, not just those with language disorder or literacy disorders, but sort of like the whole population, kind of like Trina's focus as well. And I'm super excited to be here. So thanks for having us.
I was just about to say, we've had many listeners write in about dynamic assessments. We have very, very briefly touched on it in previous episodes related to comprehensive speech and language assessments and the bias that is inherent in standardized assessments and how speech and language pathologists over rely on standardized assessments in the culture of our evaluation skills, if that's a thing. We're so excited to dive into this a little deeper. This is an area that we're interested in, but not within Amy and our scope of competence. So we're just excited to have the experts here to tell us exactly what the deal is. Before we get started, I want to quickly read our learning objectives and then run through our financial and non-financial disclosures as fast as possible. Listeners, we know that this is the boring and dry part. I promise I will try and get through it as fast as possible. So learning objectives, learning objective number one, explain the theoretical basis of dynamic assessment. learning objective number two, explain the difference between static and dynamic assessment. Learning objective number three, describe three dynamic assessment formats that SLPs can use. Disclosures, Dr. Peterson and Dr. Spencer's financial relationships, they're both co-authors of the Story Champs curriculum and Pearl Dynamic Assessment. They receive royalties from the sale of those items. Dr. Spencer and Dr. Peterson have no financial relationships to disclose. Kate, that's me. I'm the owner founder of Grandbois Therapy and Consulting and co-founder of SLP Nerdcast. My non-financial disclosures, I'm a member of ASHA Stig 12 and serve on the AAC Advisory Group for Massachusetts Advocates for Children. I'm also a member of the Berkshire Association for Behavior Analysis and Therapy, MassABA, the Association for Behavior Analysis International, and the corresponding Speech Pathology and Applied Behavior Analysis Special Interest Group. Amy Wonka's financial disclosures. Amy is an employee of a public school system and co-founder of SLP Nerdcast. Amy's non-financial disclosures, she is a member of ASHA Stig 12 and serves on the AAC Advisory Group for Massachusetts Advocates for Children. So guys, tell us everything that you know. We're so excited. Let's get into it.
All right. Well, we have a lot to talk about with dynamic assessment, but before I let Doug give his little spiel, start on his soapbox, because I might not ever get the microphone back. let me say one thing is that when I was a clinician, I was actually a school psychologist. And then when I met Doug in our doctoral training program, he's an SLP, we both loved dynamic assessment. And so it was like an area in which we bonded over. And so our collaboration kind of like grew out of like a shared, you know, interest in this assessment modality. And we have kind of, you know, pursued further knowledge around dynamic assessment as kind of a collaborative and interprofessional collaborative team. So it's been really fun. And we, you know, we challenge each other on this topic and others all the time. Sometimes I'm like, no, I think you're biased about that. Or I think in some situations it's this. And so we kind of give a good balance to this, this topic and others. Wouldn't you say, Doug?
Mm-hmm. I think so. And I think we were really fortunate. I hate to do a shout out here, but I think we were very fortunate to go to Utah State University. We had Ron Gillum there, who's a pioneer in this field in dynamic assessment, and other people around us, of course, that supported this focus on dynamic assessment. So we were very fortunate to have amazing mentors.
Mentors are everything. They're so important. That's so great. Totally appropriate shout out.
Yes, mentors and good colleagues. Right.
Agreed. Here.
Sure. Good colleagues make a world of difference.
They do. All right, Doug, why don't you tell us what dynamic assessment is? We'll start there.
Okay. Well, so it's an interesting question, actually. I think maybe better would be the question, what does dynamic assessment measure? I feel like that could have been framed better, Trina. We'll work on that later.
It's my fault.
Mm-hmm. Because the real idea here is that it's all about the construct of what dynamic assessment is measuring, the thing, the construct, right? And dynamic assessment is measuring someone's ability to learn. It's measuring their modifiability. And that is very, very distinct, right, from what you get with static or traditional measures, which just simply measure what you already know. And I think that's probably the best way to define dynamic assessment, by the outcomes that you get from it and the interpretations, the inferences that you can make from dynamic assessment. That was a little bit pedantic, I'm sorry, but I mean, I think that just sort of like sets the stage for what dynamic assessment is, right? And so there's some contrast that you can make between dynamic assessment and static assessment. And this sounds like a lecture and I don't want to make it that way, but I'm just saying, you think about dynamic assessment, there's this idea, first of all, that it can be used to classify individuals as people who do or do not have a particular disorder. And you can get that with static assessment as well. But then they start to diverge in like how that's done. So with dynamic assessment, it's very interactive. Like, you know, with a traditional assessment, you're not teaching to that test. And if you were teaching to that test, you would be violating the standardized procedures and you'd feel like a big cheater. But in dynamic assessment, that is what you do, is you teach to the test. And then what you're doing is you are measuring someone's learning potential as you go through that. And it's measuring how someone learns. Okay, Trina, clean it up.
Yeah, you forgot to talk about performance versus process, which is really important because most of our assessments, everything that everybody in the world knows, we're actually measuring current performance. And all that individual's learning history was assumed, right? Because we assume that everybody was taught the same way and therefore they should all perform the same way on a particular test, right? But in dynamic assessment, we ignore that. We ignore the history and we ignore current performance, well, to some degree, right? But it's less emphasized. And we emphasize or focus on the learning process and the extent to which an individual or child, in most of our cases, if we're talking about speech language pathology, the extent to which that child can learn, right? And how they go about doing that. What are the obstacles? What are the barriers? What strengths that do they have that they bring to bear into that learning situation, right?
I can't say enough how awesome this concept is and how important it is because, you know, as speech pathologists, and I know we mentioned this briefly, we tend to think of assessments as these static assessments. That's often how we're trained in graduate school, relying on these flip books and standardized measures. And yet the purpose of assessment is to drive your treatment. And what do you need to know in treatment? It's how someone learns. What kind of prompting procedures do they need? What kinds of supports do they need? So this is just critical.
And I have a question. I wonder too, just as somebody who likes to make a picture in my mind of things, as somebody who's given a lot of standardized language assessments, I picture those flip books and, you know, filling in the protocol and saying exactly what the directions tell me to say. What does it look like? Can you give us a little bit of contrast between how it might look different? How does that look when I'm sitting down to do a dynamic assessment?
So I'll say something, you see if you want to correct it. Okay, Doug? All right.
I will, but go ahead.
I think that you would be surprised that it looks almost exactly the same. And I'll tell you, that's because there's a misnomer that dynamic assessment cannot be standardized. That's a misnomer, right?
Tell us more.
So, yeah, my brain exploded just a little bit.
Yeah. I know you already said, like, you already compared it to standardized assessment. And that's very common. Most people do. But
are you telling me I already made a mistake? That's fine. That's fine. I do it all the time. That's why I'm here. Teach me, well, Trina.
It's actually one of the things as like a school psychologist and somebody who cares about assessment, right? We're constantly coming up against like misunderstandings in the assessment world. Even people who really know assessment well still talk about standardized tests. And what standardization actually means that you're using uniform standardized administration procedures and scoring procedures, right? It doesn't necessarily mean that you can't have a learning segment or a teaching segment. And the real only difference between a static and a dynamic assessment is that there's some sort of teaching going on. That's the only real difference. And dynamic assessment in terms of form and function, they're very broad, right? Very broad and very diverse. So,
can I ask a follow-up question? Can you tell us a little bit more about how that might look? If I'm using, let's say I'm using a standardized tool and I've historically used it, you know, exactly as it's written in the manual, I do want to ultimately obtain a standard score. If I'm obtaining a standard score, does that mean that I'm following all of those protocols? How do I integrate in this dynamic component?
Okay.
Doug, do you want to answer this? Because you know I'm chomping at the bit.
Fine, just keep going. Keep going.
No, it's your turn. And it's fun to correct you. I'm just kidding.
No. Go ahead, Trina. I'll fix whatever you say.
Okay. Well, so as a school psychologist, I had to, by law, do lots of norm reference standardized tests. And I am very clear about it, right? It is a norm reference standardized test because I'm looking for eligibility determinations and I'm trying to compare a child's performance to that of a norm group, right? That's generally the type of assessment we're talking about. And IQ testing is what school psychologists do, right? And so you can administer that norm reference standardized test like Stanford-Binet, the WISC, right? In a very standardized way, right? you have to do that legally to be able to get your scores. But then you and I both know that for those kids who are minimally verbal or who engage in serious behavior problems or who are anxious, they did not perform well, right? For all sorts of reasons. And so I'm not seeing that child's true abilities. So when I was a school psychologist, what I would do is I would give that test and then I would take some of those items and then teach them. And I would collect data on things like how quickly they acquired that skill. How many trials did it take me to be able to get this kid to learn that thing I wanted him to teach? Also, could this child generalize that skill if I taught it in like 2 minutes? Could I try a new target and would they generalize to that skill? How many prompts were required? You know, what type of prompts? How many interfering behaviors occurred? How many times did I have to redirect that kid? All of those things became my observations, and I call those dynamic abilities, right? Because those are about how a child learns. And what ended up happening is I actually worked outside of New York City as a school psychologist, and I would get all these calls to be the independent evaluator because my reports were like, here's your test scores, and you know, they're not valid, but here's a bunch of information, and I could fill like 10 pages of information about how that child learns, right? Now, my version of dynamic assessment for those kind of kids were not very standardized, right? Those were not standardized, but they were adding on top of it a clinical dynamic assessment that provided supplemental and, in fact, more beneficial information about how that child learns. Okay, Doug.
That was beautiful. There's no cleanup, but I do want to add just a couple of things, just a couple of clarifications. You said the only difference is sort of like that teaching phase, but I do want to go back to the idea that there is one other difference, which is, of course, what it is that you're measuring, right? Between when we're talking about comparing static and dynamic assessment, right? It's that construct of measuring learning potential, someone's modifiability, I think. And then a couple of other things. Amy, you mentioned like, or maybe it was Kate, can't remember, sorry.
Fine, we don't need names.
Very interchangeable.
It's totally interchangeable.
But you were talking about this idea of the purpose. And I think it was you, Kate, who was saying the purpose of assessment is to drive instruction and to inform instruction. And I mean, just, I would.
Am I wrong again? I'm getting schooled today, guys. It's cool. I always say I don't know anything, but now I'm really, it's great. Lay it on me.
You are.
It's actually right. 5 purposes of assessment.
Right. But I mean, so you are right. That is one of the purposes of assessment, right? And you can fulfill the purposes of assessment with different types of assessments. And some of them overlap. So like static and dynamic measures can diagnose and they can also inform instruction. And they can also be interpreted through a norm reference or criterion reference lens. And Amy, you were talking about this in a way, like, how do I get these standard scores? Well, that has so much to do with just simply the interpretation of the score that you get, how you reference that score. So you can reference the score to a criterion, to an expectation, or you can reference it to a normative sample and the mean of that normative sample and how far away that child is from that mean.
And I think that is such an important point that you make right there, Doug, because Kate and I have talked a lot just about the differences between sort of your work environment too, what your work environment is looking for. Sometimes your work environment does require that standardization. Usually you also want additional information for your test. You're not just doing your test for eligibility, although sometimes, I guess, probably in psychological testing, you might really just be doing it mostly for eligibility. But you know, I think that's really important to know when you go into the assessment process, what are you trying to figure out? What are the boxes that you have to check? Do you have to check, you know, sort of this relationship to a normative sample or not? Can you tell us, I heard Trina, you said there are 5 reasons to do assessments. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. Well, there are different purposes for assessment. One of them is classification or eligibility determination diagnostics. One would be screening. Another is progress monitoring. The other one is to inform intervention and instruction. And the 5th one is what we would call program evaluation. So for SLPs, we are most involved in like eligibility diagnostics, right? However, if you're in schools or in clinics, you also need treatment information. And you need a different type of test that's going to, well, although Doug said you can get treatment or intervention information from like a norm reference standardized test, it's really not designed to do that, right? And so it might be inappropriate to develop goals from norm reference standardized test results. You would need like a language sample to follow up with, like, what exactly is this child producing and what are the actual gaps and, you know, like the grammatical errors this child is making. Like, you're not going to get enough information from a norm reference standardized test, and that's not what it's designed for, right? So you need tools that fulfill all the purposes or functions of assessment in your clinical context. And you, then of course there's a burden of knowing which one for which purpose, right? And like you said, Amy, what are the like validity and reliability criteria for that particular purpose? And this is a complex, I mean, this is a really complex topic. And I don't think school psychologists, SLPs, behavior analysts, none of us get enough training in this particular, like making evidence-based decisions using assessments, so.
Well, and can I just circle us back around just for a moment? The reason why you can have a norm reference dynamic assessment is because you can develop norms from this dynamic assessment, have a normative sample, and interpret those results, just like you can also interpret the results as a criterion reference test. So I just wanted to kind of make that clear. And I do need to say one thing, which I think is amazing. We just barely analyzed these data. Trina, you don't even know this yet, but we looked at about 400 students. We answered a dynamic assessment to them, and we asked this question, I'm getting too far ahead of ourselves. This won't work. I was asking the question, does modifiability, nobody knows what that means, but like, does a child's ability to learn, does that vary based on their grade, their gender, their socioeconomic status, whether they live in a rural or an urban location? And we found that it doesn't matter. Like, there's no significant difference between children based on those factors. So it's a within child thing that you're measuring. You're measuring their ability to learn. And it's these things like whether they're English language learners or whether they live in a tiny town in Wyoming or in a big city, those things aren't relevant. It doesn't matter really, because you're totally measuring this within child factor. I thought it was really cool, by the way.
That's incredible. And you know what it's making me think of? It's highlighting, aside from all the things I don't know, it's highlighting how important this is and how important this, you know, how important in how much it contrasts what we know about static assessments. And yet that's how we're trained. So in a previous episode, we reviewed some literature about the practices of speech pathologists. And I think it was, we like went back in a time machine to 1993. And how speech pathology even then was over-relying on static assessment. And I'm wondering where dynamic assessments came from, like where in history, and how is it that we haven't been more informed and trained in this type of assessment? I guess that was a two-parter.
Well, I'm gonna say one thing, it comes from psychologists, right? But even psychologists don't get this training, so. Doug, do you want to talk more about Vygotsky and Feuerstein?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to bore the world here, but I mean, we have some pretty amazing pioneers out there like Vygotsky and Feuerstein and others. And really, I mean, I think we can boil it down to this concept or this idea that you get from both Vygotsky and from Feuerstein. So Vygotsky's got this idea, of course, everybody's heard of the zone of proximal development, right? So it's like children, you can see how well children can learn with support. And Feuerstein also had the same idea of you can measure, you can identify how well someone learns with mediation. He called it mediated learning. And I love, Feuerstein like has this, to me, it's like a revelation. He asks this question. He says, what if intelligence was not a fixed attribute, measurable once and for all? What if intelligence can be taught and was in fact the ability to learn? And it's like, he's got this light bulb moment, like, wait a minute, maybe someone's intelligence, and he's a psychologist, he's focused on that, right? But he's like, maybe someone's intelligence isn't really static in like what they know right now, but instead how well they can learn something. And so that's where it all originated, from Vygotsky and from Feuerstein. And then in our field, you've got to give a shout out to Liz Pena, who I think was the very first speech language pathologist to do dynamic assessment with language. And she was working with Aquiles Iglesias at the time. I think it was her dissertation. And I feel like this is a brilliant moment where Liz is like, wait a minute, I wonder if we can identify language disorder by measuring someone's ability to learn language, that specific construct. And I mean, not to like, you know, tell the whole story, but essentially every study that people do on dynamic assessment of language finds that yes, with considerable accuracy, you can identify disorder by measuring that construct of language learning.
So Doug's totally right, especially he's bringing it more relevant to speech language pathologists, but the historical roots of dynamic assessment came from psychologists who were trying to identify individuals who could benefit from school, right? That's their original purpose. So individuals with disabilities who were pretty profoundly impaired, and they were determining like who gets to go to school and who's going to benefit from school. And so they created these teaching tests to determine if somebody was educable or not, right? And that sounds really terrible in our culture and our society, but originally that's what it was. It was a very, you know, fluid, loosey-goosey type of IQ test to determine if somebody's can learn, like if somebody can learn, right? Well, of course we know everyone can learn and that they have a right to effective education, right? Nowadays, but originally that was the primary purpose. The other thing that's important is like that mediation that he was talking about through the mediated learning experience that Feuerstein came up with. It was not standardized in any way. It was like the clinician, the examiner gets to teach however they want to, right? And then they would, you know, come with some sort of like judgment about that child or that individual's ability to learn, right? But I think also, didn't Liz Pena also have some connection to Carol Litz?
And oh yeah, well, I know she collaborated a lot with Carol.
Yeah, so those are psychologists who are strong dynamic assessment researchers too. So I think she had some influence from psychologists in her early days. So she was the one that definitely brought dynamic assessment to speech language pathology.
I am wondering about something. So given the landscape that you've painted, everything from history to the relevance and importance of dynamic assessments, and it sounds like there's lots and lots of research about how effective they are. Are they effective for all the categories of or all reasons for assessment, or just some of them? In other words, like, can you use a dynamic assessment for classification and diagnosis?
Okay, that's such a great question. It depends on what the dynamic assessment looks like. If your dynamic assessment, let's say your dynamic assessment is a dynamic assessment of non-word repetition, then I don't know that that really informs instruction, but it could still be diagnostic, right? But let's say your dynamic assessment is an assessment of narrative language and you're taking language samples, then suddenly it can be informative of intervention because you've got a language sample and you can identify what you might want to do in the real world to help that person. So, but there are other of the five, you know, purposes of assessment, there are other purposes that probably wouldn't fit very well with dynamic assessment. Wouldn't you say, Trina?
Yeah, like I think progress monitoring is a little tough, you know? It's not that it's impossible, because we have had deep conversations about using one's response to instruction as an indicator of progress, like learning progress, right? If we expect kids to become better learners over time, that might be a good indicator of progress. However, I don't know of any research uses of it in that regard. And I don't think dynamic assessment is appropriate for, program evaluation, right? That's not gonna help you. But it definitely, and like Doug said, that it depends on the type, and there are lots of types of dynamic assessment, and they have different formats depending on what it is you're teaching and what it is you're trying to, what construct you're wanting. And some have you know, depending on their format, they may have good predictive validity and then may be very good for diagnostics and classification, where others give you really explicit information about learning. Like the example I told you when I was in as a school psychologist, I was doing a dynamic assessment of sorts so I could paint a picture of what kind of learning environment was ideal for this child, right? But again, it wasn't standardized. It wasn't for diagnostic purposes. It was for clinical use and how to put this child with autism in an appropriate classroom environment, right? So let me just walk through. There's actually two main types of dynamic assessments in formats. I guess two formats that I call them: the sandwich and the cake. Wait, Doug, you want to say something?
Yeah, I just want to say one thing. You're going to make Amy very happy because she's asked this question twice now. Like, what does
it look like?
Actually look like? I'm so glad you're going to go there. Okay, go ahead.
I know. Poor Amy. They're like, okay, but we want to know this. We're like, we get it, right? Okay, so sandwich and the cake. A sandwich basically means that there's one layer of teaching in between layers of assessment, okay? And then the cake means that there's multiple layers of teaching, okay? And now, the sandwich ones are usually best for diagnostics because it's like a short, possibly a short teaching session that's very standardized in nature, at least in the type of dynamic assessments that Doug and I do. We try to give the very best teaching that we possibly can. We give a pretest and a post-test. So that's one type: test, teach, test. That's one sandwich. It's your simple grilled cheese sandwich, okay?
With a modifiability rating or reflection in the middle of it, right after the teaching phase.
Right.
Wait, say more words. What does that mean?
So Trina's saying test, teach, retest, or pretest, teach, post-test. And she's totally right. But we also want to make sure that we are measuring modifiability, how well or how easy or how difficult it was for someone to learn through that process. And so right after the teaching phase is the way we do it. Right after the teaching phase, we take a moment to reflect on that teaching experience. And we go through several operationalized behaviors that we think about. And thankfully, Trina is an applied behavior analyst. So she's been able to operationalize these behaviors that indicate whether it's difficult or easy for someone to learn. We do that modifiability. Now, I bring that up only because the cake approach doesn't necessarily have to have that modifiability rating.
Yes, you're right. We kind of talked about like the construct. What we're looking for when we do a dynamic assessment is how modifiable or how responsive that child is to instruction, right? So our construct of interest that we do need to measure if it's a sandwich is how responsive they are. And so that teaching phase, it's not just a pretest and a post-test, but it's also what happens in between. Okay.
I got to say one thing. This is a little story. I remember going to Austin, Texas and visiting Liz Pena, and we were at lunch together and Liz was sitting next to me on my right. And I'm just barely starting out in the PhD and I turn to her and I go something like, so modifiability, huh? And she goes, yep. And that was our conversation.
That's a great story.
I didn't have any follow-up questions. It was so embarrassing. She was like, wow, this guy is an idiot. But anyway, sorry.
Okay, well, let me tell you more about the sandwich because I just told you the test, teach, test, right? The basic grilled cheese, right? So there's another way that you could do it. You could do a test, teach, test, and then add another layer of bread, right? Which would be transfer. And you don't have to have a pretest for that. You could just do like a teach, test, transfer. And the transfer is about generalization. So let's say we've taught the skill, we've pretested the skill, taught that exact target, and post-tested that target. Now I wanna know if they can apply that new skill to a new, different, novel target, right? That tells us about how somebody learns, right? And whether they can acquire the skill, let's say, you know, whatever we're teaching, like a narrative, you know, a narrative structure, you know, whether they can apply it to a new thing, okay? So that's the sandwich kind. There's just this one teaching phase and there's modifiability built into the scoring of that. Yeah.
Before we move away from the sandwich, something that Doug said was that Trina is really good at operationalizing this. And we have these like reflective questions that we use is that a thing that's maybe written up in a paper somewhere? Or if our listeners are saying, wow, I want to learn how to do those reflective questions, is there a place where they can learn more about that?
Yes.
And we don't have the corner on the market in this by any means, right? So like there are so many pioneers that came before who developed these concepts of what to measure and what to think about. But I mean, I hate to give Trina this kind of credit, but it is nice to have an analyst, right? I mean, it is so nice to have someone who is very good at operationalizing the behavior. So yeah, in all of the studies that we've published on dynamic assessment, we've listed in great detail, I think, what it is that we've looked at.
And we can have some of those references listed up on our website for our listeners, because I know that that's something I'm excited to go read more about.
Mm-hmm. So one of our early arguments about dynamic assessment, and, you know, earlier I said we were all collaborative and, you know, we sang Kumbaya. We didn't. We argued a lot, right? It was mostly us like going, no, no, that's not going to work. How dumb is that? You know, kind of idea. But what was great about it is we ended up with really great compromises, right? Because he loves this like mediated learning experience and this clinician driven, you know, teaching phase. And I was like, yeah, but if you don't operationalize it, we can never take it mainstream, right? Because we can't replicate it. If the least or, you know, like the least trained individuals in a school building or whatever, if they cannot do it with fidelity, with precision, right? With reliability, then it's garbage, right? It's not going to happen. It's not going to be useful, at least not for diagnostic purposes. Like we can still get clinical benefits from a dynamic assessment that is not, you know, replicable, but it's still like, you know, glorified clinical opinion, like my reports were when I was doing those evals. So it's very important. And we believe that this is one of the revolutionary aspects of dynamic assessment and why we promote it today. Like we don't necessarily promote, you know, Feuerstein's version of dynamic assessment because it's not gonna work in the context that SLPs work today. They need to have something more operationalized, and we can make compromises here. And we do make compromises by creating these formats with then elements that can be, that lend itself to reliability and validity evaluations.
Ooh, and can I say something about that? Because that has been on our minds so much, and all of the people that we talk to, it's also on their minds. Like, how do you get reliable results with this rating scale? And I think that it was Maria Resendiz who did a study on looking at the reliability of modifiability. And then also in our studies, we've looked at that as well. Because you think about how this sounds to a speech language pathologist. Oh, you do some treatment and then you kind of like reflect on it. Oh, you know, yeah, I feel like it was really hard for them or easy. We're not really going for that kind of loosey goosey kind of language, right? We want something that's replicable, and it is crucial. Dynamic assessment has to have the same degree, the same evidence of validity and reliability as any other assessment, including norm reference assessments. It's not like there's a lower bar for those. And so you have to have reliability. So, I mean, that's, again, I keep calling you out, Trina, but that's what, you know, it's sort of helpful to be able to really pinpoint the behavior you're looking for, and then, you know, try to get reliability across the behaviors.
And I might just plug that this is why you need interdisciplinary team members, right? Because these strengths are not going to be in every discipline. It's going to be a mixture of what assets each profession brings to the table. And, you know, it just so happens that I had a lot of testing experience and I'm a behavior analyst to be able to really operationalize behaviors. And Doug was a fan. And actually, I didn't even know the term dynamic assessment until I met Doug, but I was clearly doing it, right? I was doing it like instinctively. I understood that I needed to do an assessment of this child's learning, not just what he could do up to this point. So thanks to Doug, I know what dynamic assessment is, right?
And narratives too.
Yeah, but I totally improved upon that. So that's another conversation. We'll talk about that later. But let me get to the cake.
I was going to say, yes, cake, I have cake. More questions. I have lots more questions, but I want to hear about the cake.
All right, so the cake is the other type of format. Remember, it's the one that has multiple layers of teaching. And there are two general kinds. And interestingly enough, we actually have dynamic assessments that use these formats as well. And we actually have, Doug and I have created dynamic assessments for our research that use all four of the different formats that we're talking about. Again, for different purposes, different content, that kind of thing. So a graduated prompting would simply be, we're teaching something, but we're going to increase our prompts each time a child fails to do it correctly, or, you know, at the very highest possibility. So as child needs more help, we supply it. And then we record, usually in a graduated prompting, you're recording how many prompts or how intrusive or how severe were those prompts. A child who needs more prompts than a child who needs less prompts indicates, you know, more significant learning supports or needs for more supports. So you can, it's kind of like a least to most graduated prompting system. And as long as you're recording that very carefully, you know, you can use the data to compare kids, to compare a child to a group, to compare a child to a reference score.
Yeah, a really great example of that, and I know we're going to talk about examples later, but a really great example of that is a dynamic assessment of morphological awareness that Julie Walter put together, and she published, I think it's in LSHSS, Language Speech Hearing Services in Schools. And so if you want to see a good example of how to do this cake approach, this graduated prompting approach, that's a really well done dynamic assessment.
Mm-hmm. And again, we'll have all of these references and links to these articles in the show notes and on our website. So if anybody is listening to this and feeling like they are driving and can't jot any of this down, don't worry. It's all written down somewhere. We will put it up there.
Right.
So we've gone through the cake. Is there anything else to discuss about the cake?
Yeah, there is. They're still testing the limits. One more. I'm sorry, you guys.
No, it's good. It's good. I'm just chomping at the bit to ask a question.
All right. Well,
I can wait. I'm a big girl.
Well, let me just tell you quickly. Testing the limits is not necessarily adding more prompts, but changing the task, right? You're kind of like sequentially making the task harder and harder, right? It's almost the opposite of graduated prompting, but they're different, right? Because it's about task versus prompts, like how much support versus the task itself, right? And a good example is if you're doing a dynamic assessment with AAC. So different modality, or sorry, let me talk about this, ready? Different software, you have different number cells on your device, right? If you start with like a 10 square and then you move up to 16 or 24, that is testing the limits because you are testing, teaching this child with this one, but hey, they seem to get this. They're not struggling with this board. So let's make it harder by adding 12 or 16. I can't even remember the numbers on the cells anymore, but you get the idea that you can change the task to see the limits or to see where a child's learning or skills start to break down and where support is necessary. And it's at that limit, that's the child's zone of proximal development, where they're going to need support to be successful.
My brain's exploding.
And if I can just like, I just want to ask you a question, Trina, if I could. I think that what you're saying is that approach though, isn't really diagnostic, right? That approach is more like informing instruction or intervention in a way, right? It's sort of like, what does this person need to be successful to communicate? And so dynamic assessment can be used in that application.
The graduated prompting cake is how much support is the child or the individual needs. But testing the limits is how far can this individual go, right? And that's like, you don't wanna shortchange them and like give them content or material or targets that they can already do easily without support. You wanna push to find out where that zone of proximal development really is, and you might not do that. Our assessment, the example that we use in testing the limits is we have a phonological awareness assessment. And we start with, we start with one type of phonological task and then we move to another one if the child meets a criterion on that first task. Then we move to another one. If the child meets criterion on that task, we move to the next one, right? It's in a sequence so that we can see exactly where their skills are and where support is needed. Right, Doug?
Yeah, right. But here, let me push for a second. How are we measuring modifiability or learning potential through that process?
We're not. We're pinpointing where and how, what skills the child is ready to learn, right? And what kind of supports in the graduated prompting anyway, what kind of supports they need. That's not necessarily the diagnostic information. Mm. That's the link to intervention, right?
Yeah.
I'm having so many brain explosions because I think I might do dynamic assessment and I didn't even know it. I mean, I think, and this sort of brings me to one of the questions that I was chomping at the bit to ask is, you know, why looking, I'm sure that looking through, so for example, the experience that I'm having right now, reflecting back on my own clinical work through a different lens. So when we do that as clinicians, we can think of things differently, think of new things, change things, modify things, you know, expand our scope of competence through a different perspective. I guess I'm just wondering why did it take, I'm not going to tell you how old I am. It's not young. Why did it take me this many years of practice to hear about this and implement my treatment or do, you know, thinking about things through the lens of dynamic assessment? How did I miss the boat? I feel left out.
You didn't miss the boat. That's a question you could ask about just about anything when it comes to education. Why does it take so long for us to adopt evidence-based practices? And why does it take so long for dynamic assessment to be adopted? There are some very real obstacles though to dynamic assessment, or I want to speak past tense. There were some real obstacles.
This is his arrogance coming through.
Yeah. Well, I know, that's embarrassing. That's embarrassing. I'm just saying, there still are obstacles, of course, but we're moving forward, right, in making this something that's much more feasible to use in the schools or in a clinic with children. And I don't know why there's so much resistance. I got to tell you one thing. Well, I've told you a million things, but let me say this. A while ago, Ron Gillum and colleagues published this paper on dynamic assessment. I think it was in 2014. And the title of the paper was like a newspaper headline. It was like, dynamic assessment accurately identifies children with language disorder. And I remember like shooting around a text, like, is this really going to be your title to your article? It was already published. He's like, yeah, because it's sort of like, this is the state of the research. You know, the preponderance of evidence is there that this is just simply how it is, no apology necessary. And so then when you see that or hear that, you think, okay, so why are people not using this? And no one's asking people to use it exclusively, right? Let's be clear about that, right? Like if you're anywhere in the schools, it's illegal for you to use a single test exclusively. It's like in the law that you can't even do that. So we're not saying that you should do that, but the question is, why is it not part of your assessment process? It's a great question. Trina can answer it. I'm talking to you.
I forgot what the question was.
What? Well, you just totally zoned me out. I love it. The question.
I ignore you all the time, but this isn't any different.
Hey, the question is, why isn't anybody using it?
Oh, well, I guess that there are still some, so I would say because its origins are psychology and Feuerstein and Vygotsky were more like classic dynamic assessment people, and they didn't standardize it and they were intentional about it, right? It was intentionally not standardized. So it has scoring issues, reliability issues, and validity probably less so, but it had, you know, like you can't replicate it. And I would say in that classic dynamic assessment understanding, you know, if we don't make improvements, methodological improvements to suit our mainstream needs these days, nobody's going to understand them. And oftentimes dynamic assessment does get like, kind of like dismissed as clinical opinion, right? But there are ways to make it more standardized. It can be more replicable and produce reliability and validity evidence to support its use.
I'm going to say something back to you to make sure that I have understood and that our listeners have understood. Dynamic assessment is different than clinical judgment, and it is different than diagnostic treatment. Correct or incorrect?
What do you mean by diagnostic treatment?
So diagnostic treatment, I think, is something that maybe is dynamic assessment. I don't know. That's why I'm part of my question that people do. So for example, if you are in a therapy, in an outpatient clinic or in a school, and it's not time, it's not that time of year to do an assessment. You're not supposed to be, quote, doing an assessment, but you need to figure out if your student or client has changed in response to your treatment. So I think a casual way of saying it, maybe this is dynamic assessment, is doing, maybe it's one of those, maybe it's the sandwich or the cake. It's pushing the limits, or, you know, doing some graduated prompting to figure out if the student or client has responded to your intervention. I think casually we call that, or at least people in my circle call it, diagnostic treatment, but that sounds like it's very different from dynamic assessment.
Are you talking about progress monitoring? Like trying to figure out if your client is...
Right. So I guess my question is, does dynamic assessment go by many names? In other words, are people doing it without realizing it? And how is that different than clinical judgment?
So my guess is that they are not really doing it properly, right? And it's very different than monitoring. And one of the things that kind of helps people understand dynamic assessment is to compare it to response to intervention. In schools, we use like an MTSS framework, and the construct is response to intervention. And what happens is you give them a fall screening, right? We identify kids who need some sort of tier two intervention. We provide tier two intervention and we monitor their progress, or we just assess them again, like 3 to 5 months later. And that gives us some sort of a test, teach, test, right? Result. And in a way, that's
sandwich.
Yes,
it's a sandwich.
Right? That's response to intervention. That's that construct. So dynamic assessment is similar, but there's one really, really critical difference, is that response intervention is systemic and it's over long time. Dynamic assessment, if you're going to do a dynamic assessment, it's done in a single session. Right now, there are ways to do it long time. And some of Liz Pena's dynamic assessments are like across four weeks. But I think the dynamic assessment that we would like to promote is that a dynamic assessment occurs with an individual and it's in the same session, right? We do this test, teach, test, or test, teach, test, transfer, or graduated prompting, or whatever it is within that same session to give diagnostic or clinically or, you know, intervention relevant information about that child, right? And that is different than progress monitoring, because basically in response to intervention, the test you give at the pretest, static, right? What you give again, like in the fall you gave it and in the winter you gave it again, those are static assessments.
So dynamic assessment is in a sense conceptual. And so people are using it in concept in different ways, but it's kind of like this idea of a curriculum-based measure and a curriculum-based assessment. Now, I don't want to get, that's too much into the weeds, right? But like they're conceptually very similar, but one has evidence of validity and evidence of reliability. That's the curriculum-based measure. That has the evidence behind it. And it's sort of like a stand, not sort of, it is a standardized approach. So you could do dynamic assessment that doesn't have validity or doesn't have evidence of validity or reliability. But I think that really what Trina and I are trying to talk about is dynamic assessment that can be replicated, that is reliable, and that is valid, that SLPs and others can use in clinical practice.
Well, and you're making me think of kind of that third learning objective, which really does connect with what are dynamic assessment formats that SLPs can use? And I feel like, you know, I'm walking away with some really nice food imagery that's going to help me remember some of those different types. Maybe you guys could walk us through kind of some examples for the practitioner. You know, if what you have been doing is, let's say, a standardized speech and language assessment, norm referenced, maybe a norm referenced articulation measure, and then a language sample and an interview with a classroom teacher, right? Like that is what your assessment has kind of looked at. How might a clinician modify that to incorporate more elements of dynamic assessment?
Well, that's a tricky question. Now, if you're asking them to make, are you saying how would they make up their own dynamic assessment?
I'm saying like what types of formats, kind of just thinking about that third objective, like what are some different formats that an SLP could use? Is it kind of just the format of test, teach, test? Is it the difference between sort of those graduated prompting methods, or is that a bigger conversation in and of itself?
Well, I mean, that definitely is a big conversation, but I think we could be pretty succinct about it. It is a great question. I think though, if an SLP or anyone is going to create their own dynamic assessment, they still have that pressure to make sure that there's reliability and validity to it. And there are actually really great tutorials on how to do that. Is it Macaulay and Swisher? I think they have an article. It's something like Familiar Strangers about criterion reference to measures. It can sort of walk you through what you need to have in your criterion reference test for it to be valid and reliable. The way that Trina and I have done dynamic assessment is through narratives, and we've had children do it pre-test and retell. We have them listen to a story, then they retell that story, and we get pre-test information. It's a language sample. Then we teach them how to tell stories, and we make sure that they include all of the story grammar elements and some features of complex language. And we teach them with, it's a systematic approach, and we remove visual scaffolds until they're able to do it, or as best they can, do it independently through that teaching phase. Then we do a modifiability rating scale, and then we give a post-test, a different story, and we ask them to retell that story and we score it. And so that gives us pre-test information, modifiability information, and post-test information. And we published that, other people have published similar tests, right? And we do have it published, and hopefully it's clear. And I remember Teresa Ukrainitz saying to us, you need to make sure that you include in the study how to interpret the results. Not just here is a regression analysis, but no, here are the cut points that get you the sensitivity and specificity that you need.
All right, I have one more hopefully clinical hint, right? There is a difference between a dynamic assessment approach and a dynamic assessment instrument. And dynamic assessment instruments need to be reliable and valid, and they're typically used for classification or diagnostics. A dynamic assessment approach could be something simple that an SLP can use to supplement their evals and or with a child to determine what kind of treatment targets. And that's more clinically relevant. And I would say the test, teach, test, or the sandwich is more about classification and instrument, and the cake is more dynamic approach, clinically relevant. Now, it's not totally that simple. It's not that black and white, but at least that gives you a place to start.
This is amazing. This is my brain, I feel like I learned a lot. Well, I got schooled a lot, but in a good way, in a very, very good way. Before we close out, do you have any other like burning gems that you're dying to tell us about?
I think the takeaway, just real quick, is that there really is quite a lot of research on dynamic assessment. And what is pretty awesome about it is that it is consistently strong in identifying children who have language disorder, even when they're culturally and linguistically diverse, which we didn't even get into, right? But it doesn't even matter if they have another language that they speak at home or whatever it might be, they're socioeconomically diverse. It doesn't seem to be much of a factor. I'm not saying it isn't at all, but yeah, there's lots of great evidence out there for it.
And I do have one more thing to say too, is that I think that there's a lot of room to improve the kinds of things that you're already doing clinically by being more intentional about the data that you collect. So I am pretty sure that you use some dynamic assessment approach in your AAC evals. So if you want to talk further about how to make that more formal so you can use concrete data to make your decisions, then I would love to have those conversations. Because I think there's a lot of areas that are just ripe for like evolution.
We high five you 1,000 times over at that statement. And I can't say thank you enough for joining us and schooling me publicly, but also teaching everyone so many wonderful things. I'm hoping a lot of people are going to reflect on their own practice through this lens and think about how they can embrace dynamic assessment or seek more additional information about dynamic assessments. For anyone who is listening, who has additional questions, you can reach out to us anytime. There will be resources up on our website and in the show notes on your podcast player. And you can use this episode for ASHA CEUs. Just cruise on over to our website to take the quiz. And thank you so much for joining us today, everyone.